The views expressed on this program are those of the host and the participants.
Greetings. Welcome to Media Matters again. I'm Bob McChesney, your host today on WILL AM 580 here in beautiful Urbana, Illinois. The numbers, for those of you who have a pad at home, 333-9455 for local calls. The toll-free statewide number, 1-800-222-9455. Because today we've got a terrific show. On the line with us, joining us from Massachusetts, is one of the really outstanding media scholars, media critics, and public figures discussing media issues in the United States today, Sut Jolly. Sut, are you there?
Yeah, I am.
Great to hear your voice, Sut. Sut is probably known to most Americans to the extent he is known for a series of videos that he has done, or that you've done, Sut, the most famous of which is Dreamworld's Desire, Sex, Power, and Music video. You're also a professor at the University of Massachusetts, where you've won the Best Professor Award. It sounds like that's an annual ritual for you out there. And most importantly, from my vantage point, you're the founder and executive director of an organization called the Media Education Foundation, perhaps the leading, if not one of the leading, certainly one of the leading media literacy, media education groups in the country. Could you tell us a little bit about the Media Education Foundation?
Sure. We started about 10 years ago, as you said, as a result of actually this first tape that I did, Dreamworld, which was to do with images of women on MTV and its connection with sexual violence. And in fact, MTV threatened to sue me over the tape because of they claimed I was violating their copyright. And as a result of the controversy, I set up the Media Education Foundation. And so we've been in operation for 10 years now. We've expanded from that single tape we started off with. We now offer about 40 tapes. And as you said, I think we may actually be the largest media education organization in the country.
So how many tapes does the Media Education Foundation make on an annual basis now?
We make about 6 or 7 a year.
And these are an hour long about usually?
At the most. They're made for classrooms. They're made for university and college classrooms and high school classrooms and for community groups. So we try and keep them in a length that would allow them to be shown that also have discussion. Because there's actually not enough discussion about media issues in this country. We have about 40 tapes at the moment, and what we try and do is we try and take the latest sort of cutting-edge media research and try and put it into an accessible format so you don't have to be an expert to understand this. Because that's what's really needed. We need to get discussions about media there amongst the general population rather than just be reserved for the few people who study it.
And what has the response been by teachers and students over the last 10 years? I mean, are you finding a lot of people using and responding to the material?
Well, we've expanded from when I first started off, there was me and one videotape, and I now have a staff of 20 people.
My God, you're becoming a conglomerate. I'm going to have to write a book about you.
Right.
An expose.
Yeah. Well, we haven't quite got to that stage yet. So we're not going to be competing with Time Warner just yet. But we're a large organization now. And what's distinctive about us is we both produce videotapes and educational materials and DVDs. And we also distribute them as well.
Mm-hmm.
My understanding on this is that unless you can have distribution that goes along with production, you're not really engaged in politics, you're not really engaged in education. And there's a lot of great films that are being made out there, perhaps, left-wing progressive films, but because there's no attention being paid to distribution, no one's seen them. And so the effect of them has been minimal. And what we try and do at the Media Education Foundation is to pay equal attention to both those things, to produce materials that will give people a new way of looking at the world, that will elicit discussion and debate, and also to spend a lot of money trying to make sure that those materials get out and are seen and are heard.
And I saw a figure somewhere, I think it was in your biography, that 2 million people have seen MEF videos in the past decade?
No, I think it's more than that. I think there's 2 million people have seen just Dreamworld.
Just Dreamworld.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's tough for us to know how many people see our videos on an annual basis. But we sort of did a rough calculation the other day, and we think that every single year, between 2 and 2.5 million people actually see our videos. And this is more than just seeing them on television, because they're shown in classrooms.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's not like you can turn it off. It's not like you can be doing other things while it's going on. It's normally integrated into a classroom, and there's normally discussion around it. So I think the impact of our videos is even greater than if they were on well, they're not going to be on the networks, but even greater than if they were, you know, perhaps on PBS, because there's discussion that goes around it, and I think because of that, the issues are much more intense.
What are some of the, just to give our listeners an idea of what sort of material is covered, what are like the last three or four Media Education Foundation videos that you've produced?
Just the ones we're finishing up this summer, I'll just give you a sense of that. We just finished a video on public relations called A Toxic Sludge is Good for You, which is based on the book by John Stauber and Sheldon Rampton.
Well, John Stauber, in fact, was a guest on Media Matters just a month or so ago.
So you know the kinds of things he talks about, but it's a film about, you know, the public relations industry, which, as John, I'm sure, pointed out, I mean, I think is one of the most important ideological institutions in the country, and yet something that is invisible.
Mm-hmm.
So we try and, you know, put a spotlight on this thing that normally works invisibly. So there's a video on toxic sludge, on the public relations industry. We just finished another video on the representation of female athletes. That is, you know, in the wake of this tremendous expansion of, you know, women and girls playing sports, what's the reaction being from the culture? And so we look at how the media representation of female athletes has tried to put them back into very distinct sort of either domestic or sexual roles.
Yeah, can you elaborate on that a little bit, Seth? That's really interesting.
Well, one of the things that, you know, the traditional femininity has always been about seeing women in these very narrow ways. And, you know, what Title IX did was it made, you know, which is now come with 30 years of it, what that did was to expand the number of girls and women who are playing sports. And that is, in fact, an incredible challenge, I think, to the sort of dominant way in which gender was viewed. Because women were supposed to be there on the sidelines, you know, as decorations or as support. And for the last 30 years, women and girls have been active participants and playing the things that normally is have been intruded into a world that is normally defined as male. And so what we were interested in looking at was, well, how has, in fact, especially the sports world, how have the male journalists in the sports world reacted to this intrusion, in one way, of femininity into a traditionally male realm? And what we found is there's been a backlash against the increasing participation of girls and women in sports in a way that tries to downplay their role, tries to make it less serious. And again, and the tactics that are used to do this are pretty standard. You present women in, you know, what's important about women is not what they do on the field, but what happens to them off the field. And so women are shown, you know, in a way that emphasizes the domestic roles. They're shown with their husbands, with their children. And they're also shown in ways that emphasize their sexual roles. And so you see many more images of female athletes, in bikinis or, you know, often sometimes nude in men's magazines. Because that is a way you can take away from women's power.
Yeah, you know, there's a tennis player from Russia, Anna Kournikova, who, to the best of my knowledge, doesn't even rank in the top 50 players in the world, but she's probably the best-known tennis player in the world, or women's tennis player.
Exactly. I mean, Anna Kournikova, in fact, has never won a professional tournament. And, in fact, you know, it's just in terms of, you know, just looking at Russia, you know, there's four other Russian players that are ranked higher than Anna Kournikova. But she is, I mean, you know, her money doesn't come from prize money. Her money comes from the fact that she fits into a very glamorous, fashion-oriented image. And she's one of the best-known people on the planet.
Now, what accounts for this? What's the explanation you would give for this that explains why we get this type of a coverage and framing of this extraordinary story of a surge of women's participation in sports and athletics?
I mean, I think there's lots of ways of looking at it, but I think in one way, it's what you're seeing is men's anxieties at stake. And again, I think whenever we see images, you know, we always have to say, well, someone constructed these images. So what's going on in the minds of those people who construct these images and the minds of those people who choose these images? And I think the image of Anna Kournikova is a very unthreatening image. It's an image that fits in perfectly into male fantasy in which, you know, the women are there for the pleasure of men. And it's not surprising to me. And, you know, at that point people can say, well, look, we cover women's sports. We have, you know, they have pictures of Anna Kournikova on our stories of Anna Kournikova, but it's in a very, very safe way. And I think the reason for that is because there is women intruding into male space is very threatening.
Now,
Anna Kournikova is, you know, is a very traditional way to think about female sports or female athleticism.
How much does commercialism factor in? And let me add a little bit more to this question, because I've noticed that in some of the fledgling women's sports leagues, or when they have women's sports teams trying to raise money, they've employed somewhat traditional manners, playing on sort of fashion shots of the athletes to generate interest and support, to try to basically be more commercially viable. How much does that play into it?
No, a tremendous amount, I think. There's the commercial aspect of it, which means, they've got to be able to be fit into, the rest of the image system that we see. And within that, women are shown in very particular ways, and so, you can't challenge within that. The other reason, I think, for this is that women's sports has always been connected with homosexuality.
Mm-hmm.
And that's that old stereotype of, the dykes who play baseball, play sports. And so when you're trying to establish women's sports in a serious way, you've got to have that in mind. You've got to realize that, in fact, out there in the culture, there is this connection between women's sports and homosexuality. And so you have to do everything you can to distance yourself from it. And the two most predominant ways, as I said, of doing that is representing women in a domestic way. That is, if you show women with their husbands and their boyfriends and their children, they can't be gay. And if you show women in very traditional, heterosexual, sexist poses, then they can't be gay as well. And so it helps protect from the notion that only gay women play sports, or only gay sports fans should watch sports.
So it shouldn't be taken seriously by anyone else.
Right, exactly.
We're talking with Sut Jolly today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. This is a live show. It inadvertently said on our website that we were pre-recording the show, so we are taking phone calls. The number here at the studio is 333-9455, our toll-free number for those outside the Champaign-Urbana area, 1-800-222-9455. The lines are open. Please call in if you have any questions for Sut Jolly, who is talking to us on the phone from Massachusetts. We've been discussing some of the recent videotapes that his Media Education Foundation has produced that are going to be released and shown in high schools and colleges across the country. Any others you'd like to mention before we move on, Sut?
I'll mention actually perhaps the most controversial one that we will be doing. And this is slated for completion sometime in the fall, but we're doing a video on the media representation of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, which is called Peace, Propaganda, and the Promised Land, News Bias in the Israeli-Palestinian Conflict. And he really looks at the way in which Israel has really been able to colonize and to control the debate around the Middle East in a very, very narrow way. And so we look at the history of that, and we look at what the contours of that are, so that at the present time, Americans are literally incapable of understanding what is going on in the Middle East.
Now, you're talking about the press coverage in the United States of Israel-Palestine.
Yes.
In the Middle East, not the press coverage in Uruguay or someplace like that.
Well, no, and the press coverage in the United States matters for Israel in a way that the press coverage of the issue in Uruguay doesn't, because the United States gives billions of dollars of aid every year to Israel.
Mm-hmm.
And for that aid to keep flowing, it means that the American population essentially has to be kept ill-informed of what's going on. No. Essentially, Israel, and I want to say Israel, I want to be very clear, the government of Israel, and the right-wing government of Israel,
mm-hmm.
is essentially fighting two wars.
Mm-hmm.
They're fighting a war in the occupied territories against Palestinians. But they're also fighting a war in America as well. And the enemy here is American public opinion. And they've got to keep American public opinion contained. Because if ordinary Americans actually found out the real issues at stake in the Middle East, then those ordinary Americans, being compassionate, being concerned with justice, being concerned with democracy, would put pressure on their representatives to stop the unbelievable amount of aid that goes to the government of Israel to carry on its repressive policies.
It's
very, very important for Israel, in fact, to conduct a public relations campaign in America to make sure that the American public opinion is kept under wraps.
Can you give an example or two of the sort of stories that are not getting covered here or getting covered poorly here about Israel and Palestine that are getting coverage in Europe or other parts of the world?
Sure. Before I get to that, what we know about the world is not accidental. What comes on in media, is not just, is not some accidental process whereby, whereby there's no structure. Everything that comes out, as we know, as your work, Bob, has made clear, everything that comes out is the result of a particular kind of institutional structure. And in terms of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, I think we can really think about the last 20 years as distinct from the previous 20 years. Because what happened when Israel invaded Lebanon in 1982 was, in fact, the American networks actually covered it in a pretty decent way. And you saw, actually, the real effects of the war. Remember that the Israeli invasion of Lebanon killed 20,000 civilians, as well as killed at least 1,000 women and children in the camps of Shabra and Shatila. I mean, the news coverage in the United States, in fact, showed it in a pretty accurate way. Well, after that, leading opinion leaders in Israel, leading politicians said, look, we're not going to let this happen again. What we need to do is we need to make sure that those kinds of images don't make their way onto American media again. And they set up a very, very particular program that was designed to control American journalists and American journalism and to make sure that what came out was were stories that whereby Americans wouldn't understand what was going on. Let me give you the two things that are sort of left out of the coverage.
Okay.
Which, if you were to, for example, if you were to watch, if you were to watch the BBC, these things would slap you in the middle of the face. The first set of stories that are left out is anything to do with the occupation. And so Americans at the moment, actually most Americans, don't know that Israel is illegally occupying the West Bank and Gaza.
They think it's the other way around?
They think it's the other way around. whatever view you may have on the occupation, you may support it or whatever else. But there's no doubting that the key aspect of the contemporary situation is that there is a military occupation by the fourth largest army in the world of the West Bank and Gaza. Now, if you don't understand that, if you don't know that, then it is impossible for you to understand what's going on. And in fact, most Americans don't know what's going on. Let me give you an example of that. I've been doing this in my classes for a while now. I teach at UMass, and I teach these very large lecture classes. I teach intro to mass comm, and so I get a lot of 18, 19-year-old kids in there. And I think a fairly good cross-section of American public opinion. And perhaps better informed than most. I mean, this is, after all, Massachusetts and a good liberal university. And I asked them earlier in the semester, I asked them a question, which is a question not of opinion, but it's a question of fact. The question I asked them is the following. I say, which of the following countries has been continually condemned in the United Nations for illegally occupying other people's land in the Middle East? Okay, that is a very unambiguous question, because Israel has been continually condemned in the United Nations for illegally occupying the West Bank and Gaza. So that's the question I ask, and then I give four choices. I think Kuwait, Lebanon, the Palestinians, and Israel. I can't call them Palestine because there's no such thing as Palestine. I have to call it the Palestinians. And what my students tell me is when I give them this question, they say, I don't know this. So they're actually sometimes very honest with me. And I say, well, you have to guess. Even if you don't know, guess. Because the guessing will tell us something. The guessing will tell us, what assumptions you use to understand the world. And consistently over the last 6 or 7 years that I've been doing this, between 58 and 66% of my students think that the Palestinians are illegally occupying land in the Middle East. Now, if you're part of the Israeli public relations machine, you are ecstatic at that number. Because it means that the American population, the vast bulk of the American population, simply does not understand the major facts about the Middle East.
Sud, I just want to let our listeners know, I've got a couple of people on the line. I want to get to them in a second, but I want to finish up this the points you're making about Israel and the coverage of the Middle East first. So please continue then.
I mean, the other aspect of that is, so on the one hand, Americans know almost nothing. At the same time, there is pretty powerful support for Israel. I mean, in most polls I looked at, and Gallup has been doing this for the last 12 years, in most polls, around 50% of Americans support Israel. So the question is, how do you explain these two things? How do you explain both, strong support for Israel and at the same time, ignorance about what's going on? Well, that's the end result of a public relations campaign.
Mm-hmm.
And the two aspects of that, I think, as I said, are, that occupation is invisible. But if you don't know there's occupation going on, then how do you make sense of the suicide bombers? The suicide bombers then just are these, mad Arabs who just are lashing out because they hate Jews. They're never placed in a concrete political context. And whatever else you may think of the suicide bombers, if you want to understand them, you've got to place them in the right context, and that context is invisible. The other thing that's missing from the American coverage is coverage of the settlements, of the illegal settlements in the West Bank. They simply don't appear. And when they do appear, they're often nowadays called neighborhoods that these are illegal, you know, under international law, they are illegal settlements. And yet in the American media, you wouldn't actually even know that there was, you know, I mean, essentially it's colonization. And Israel is colonizing the West Bank.
You know, Seth, if I can interrupt for 1 second, along these lines, I have a friend who teaches both here at Illinois and at Harvard in journalism programs. And he gives his students a quiz every semester about world leaders and historical events to see what they know. And he says routinely students, and this includes very recently, have no idea who Ariel Sharon is. And the most frequent answer he gets, is that Ariel Sharon is a character on The Little Mermaid, to give some sense of the amount of knowledge people have of the area. Now, I want to go to the phone calls in a second, but one last question I'd like to give you before we get to it to finish up this strain of thought. You know, in the last month or two, there's been a lot of press coverage of Israeli protest about the nature of media coverage in the U.S. of what's going on in the Middle East as being too pro-Palestinian. I mean, that's the debate I've been seeing in the major news media. That seems to go against what you're saying. What's that all about?
Well, that's part of the propaganda campaign. I mean, what you have to do as part of the propaganda campaign is to make sure that only certain stories get out. And then, if in fact some journalists may actually believe that they're journalists and may actually be doing their job, you have to make sure that they're silenced. And the way you silence them is by intimidating them. And so the aim of groups like, the major group is CAMRA, you know, Committee for Accuracy in Middle East Reporting. It makes me gag every time I say that, but given how they lie about stuff. It's the same thing to do. It's the same way we think about the media. I mean, the only way we're allowed to think about the media in the media is in terms of whether the media are too liberal or, you know, which is when the media are corporate and right-wing, then one of the ways in which you control that discussion is to make sure that the question you ask is the opposite of what's true. And therefore, we have to debate about whether the media are liberal, they're not liberal, instead of rethinking about and talking about whether, you know, the corporate nature of media. Well, that's the same issue that is, you know, that these the groups that are trying to put pressure on journalists are trying to do. They want to make sure that when there is a debate about media coverage, the debate is about whether, you know, the media are too pro-Palestinian or not, rather than the reality of it.
We're talking with Seth Jolly today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. We have two very patient callers I'm going to get to in a second. Let me say at this point, though, if you want to call in, we do have lines open. The number 333-9455 and toll-free number 800-222-9455. Let's go to the phone lines now. Hello, Champagne. You're on the air with Seth Jolly.
Oh, hello.
And thank you for being so patient.
Oh, that's fine. It's very fascinating. First, I have a question for the guest, but I want to thank you and Mr. Jolly for your work. It's certainly, as a left-wing progressive, I know these things, but I don't have the facts, and you've given me a lot of the facts to argue. And I use Dream Worlds. I teach women's studies at a community college and have used Dream Worlds, and I think it's affected more students than anything I've shown. I use a lot of documentaries, and it's been great. My question is, for Mr. Jolly, how you came about this consciousness, what I would call almost a radical feminist consciousness, when you were talking about women athletes and also what is reflected in Dream Worlds 2. And I'm just curious, because at one point in my political life, I was quite separatist and you know, angry at men. And the older I've gotten, the more I am so happy to have men who understand, because I think you're listened to because of power structure in our society in a way that women aren't, particularly lesbian, you know, and feminist women. And so I'm just wondering how you came about your feminist consciousness.
Well, that's a big question. I'm not too sure I can answer it in any particular way. I mean, I think if you are concerned with issues of, you know, of social justice, then I think you have to be a feminist, no matter where you come from. And so my feminism actually came out of, you know, my general political view of, you know, of looking at the world and looking at things through issues of democracy and justice. At the same time, I also realized that, in fact, being a man, that I perhaps had a special responsibility to talk about these things. Because as you said, men will sometimes be listened to on this in ways that women are not. And that was an important aspect that was an important reason why Dreamworlds, you know, is narrated by a man. It's narrated by me. Because in one sense, what, you know, I think what I was looking for was when we think about our audience, we always have an audience in mind, and we can either think that we can either have a view of the audience that we're going to talk to only people who already believe what we believe, and that's a very safe way of operating. And if you do that, you'll never go wrong, because whatever you say will be agreed upon by your audience. I don't think that's really politics. I think politics actually is reaching out to people who don't agree with you. And so when I made Dreamworlds, my target in one sense was, I made it initially just as a teaching tool for my classes. It was developed as a pedagogical tool. I used it in my classes. I tested it out in my classes. And in one sense, what I had in the back of my mind was, what I wanted to reach was that kid in the back row. He was sitting in the back row of this large lecture class, and he wasn't a particular kid, but he most probably belongs to the frat. Sits there with his baseball cap, reads a paper, and he's there because he thinks he has to be there. Now, what I wanted to do was to be able to reach out to the back row. I think it's easy to reach the front row, and we have to do that. But people are in the front row because they're already interested. But I wanted to be able to reach into the back row, and reaching into the back row meant that I had to think about strategy in a very particular way. And I knew that if I, in fact, had a woman narrating Dreamworlds, that given what's already out there in the culture around the perception of women and feminism, that person, that man, would, in fact, immediately turn off. But if there was a man doing it, then he couldn't turn off immediately, and he had to, in fact, pay attention to the arguments and had to pay attention to the ideas. So I think it's very important that we think about strategy.
Caller, do you have any follow-up you'd like to do?
No, I just want to thank you both very much. A great program. Thanks a lot.
Thank you for calling. All right. Sud, I'd like to ask you before we go to the next caller, you've also done work along these lines on masculinity. And I think, one of your premier videos was Tough Guys. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, Tough Guys is a film that we did with Jackson Katz, who is a gender violence prevention activist. To do with the construction of violent masculinity, and again, one of the reasons we did this was coming out of feminism. One of the things we know a lot about now is the image of women, and how femininity is constructed. But until very recently, there's not been a lot of work done on its opposite, on what femininity is always related to, which is masculinity. And that's the way, in fact, in which dominance works. That's the way in which dominance hides itself, by remaining unexamined. By only looking at the, in one sense, the victim side of it, or the subordinate side, you can't really get to how power really operates. And so we were interested in looking at this other side, which is the dominant side of gender, masculinity, and looking at how that was constructed, and how in the modern world masculinity is connected with power, with dominance, with intimidation, and ultimately with violence. And so the question in doing that gives us a new way to think about all kinds of questions. It gives us a new way to think about questions of violence, for example. Even within feminism, normally when we think about violence against women, that's the term that's used, is violence against women. And as a result of my work with Jackson Katz, I've actually now tried not to use that term, because I think violence against women is a very bad term to describe what's going on, because what it leaves out of it is that phrase. What it leaves out of it is the person who's doing the violence.
Mm-hmm.
If you only look at violence against women, then it's a women's issue. Then the focus is on victimization. You only have to put one word in front of it, and you change the entire notion. And that one word is men's violence against women.
Mm-hmm.
Because violence is not abstract. Violence is very concrete. And when 90% of violence is committed in the world is committed by men, and you don't look at gender, you don't look at masculinity as connected to that, we are incapable of dealing with it. And so what we wanted to do was to shine a light on masculinity, which has remained unexamined, and to really challenge men to think about their own participation in this culture of violence.
What's been the response to Tough Guys so far?
The response has been terrific. The response has been from both men and from women.
Mm-hmm.
I think men out there, I think most men want to do the right thing. I think most men want to engage in this battle, and they want to be partners with women. And up until now, we haven't had a way in which they can really be partners. We haven't had a way in which they can be involved. And what I think Tough Guys does is it certainly poses men's violence against women as a men's issue, and invites men in as active participants. Not as so what Jackson Katz does and what I do is, instead of looking at men, I think this was disastrous in feminism. In sort of the early second wave feminism, when the discussion came around violence or around pornography, there's this notion that, well, every man is a potential rapist. Because, you know, that was the argument that came from the culture. There's something about how we're constructing masculinity. Well, if you think about every man as a rapist, then what is the incentive for men to participate in the battle against rape and against sexual violence? So instead of thinking about every man as a potential rapist, I actually prefer to think about every man as a potential ally in the battle against sexism and the battle against violence. And I think if you approach men on that way, and if you approach boys in that way, I think they are dying to come on board. They are dying to do the right thing. They just haven't had the modeling to figure out how to do the right thing. And so I think tough guys gives them that opening to start thinking about their role in this, their participation in the culture of violence.
We're talking to Seth Jolly today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. So I think those of you who've been listening already can tell Sud is a remarkably knowledgeable person in a wide range of areas. We've got one caller patiently waiting I'm going to get to in a second. I just want to remind you the phone lines are open. This is a live show, 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. We will get to your call if you call in now. Let's go to the lines. Champagne, you're on the air with Seth Jolly.
Hi. I want to raise the fact that what I hear is a perspective from both of you, which is very strongly anti-Israeli. And I think that comes out in turning your perspective and opinions into facts and assuming that they're facts and citing them as facts as criticism of others' so-called opinions. And one, when you talk about the media, you're talking about, you say American media is pro-Israeli, and of course you leave out the fact that essentially European media is strongly anti-Israeli and at times anti-Semitic, pro-Palestinian, but also your own biases, which are being restated as fact over and over when you describe your bias of anti-Israeli, pro-Palestinian. Let me give some examples. Your discussion of the Lebanese invasion and war, you gave the facts about the casualties as if they were reflective of the Israeli action, instead of seeing that they were reflective of, first, the fact that there was a civil war in Lebanon, a civil war between Lebanese forces, Christian and Muslim, a civil war which also was, in a sense, precipitated by the actions of Yasser Arafat and the PLO, and all sorts of other factors, which I'm just going to touch on, but you left all of that out. The next one, you talk about the West Bank and Gaza, the fact that, yes, Israel occupied that, but it occupied it from Jordan, not from any Palestinian state, and that there is essentially an issue where you have an ongoing conflict between Israelis and Palestinians about the fact that they both claim the same land, and there are issues there that need to be worked out between those peoples, and that there are all sorts of biases. Your guest and you, it seems, have a bias pro-Palestinian. Fine, but it's important to acknowledge that, and then when you start making statements of facts, we need to look at those facts. I don't want to go, I could go into it further here.
Well, can I ask you a question, caller?
Sure.
Related to the argument that our guest is making, Seth Jolly, about the press coverage in the United States news media regarding Israel and Palestine, do you think it is pretty much accurate? Do you think it's pro-Israeli or do you think it's pro-Palestinian?
I think at times it's pro-Palestinian. I think certainly BBC is very pro-Palestinian. I think CNN sometimes is. I think ABC is sometimes. I think there's some of it that's pro-Israeli. And I think there's variations on both. And I think what's important and what's lacking is accuracy in terms of reporters looking at their own biases that come out in the way they state things. I think NPR is certainly pro-Palestinian in some of its reporters. I think Peter Kenyon, I could go on and name some others, but I really shouldn't name names. I think some of them, and it comes out from who the perspective that they're expressing when they are expressing a story. And I think what's important is to express both perspectives, the Israelis and the Palestinian perspective. I think that would be more accurate. And I think the media doesn't do that. And I think the nature of visual media tends to focus on things that are more exciting and tend to look better, which tends to be things that are more pro-Palestinian and tends to shy away from, and I've heard that there is media, both print and visual media, that shies away from, let's say, so-called suicide bombers.
Okay, well, I'll tell you what.
From visually showing that.
Okay.
Or showing the consequences of that.
Let's let Sut Jolly have a chance to respond to that. Go ahead, Sut.
Yeah, there's two issues here. On the one, that we should focus on the facts. Absolutely. I think the facts of history is what should come out. And one of the interesting things is I think the more people know about the Middle East and the more people know about the conflict, the more complex their understanding is, and the more they see that this is not simply pro-Israel versus pro-Palestine. They realize that this, in fact, is a complex issue to do with conflict over land, but at the center of that is an issue of justice. And I think the more that people know, the better. And only having 2 minutes or so to talk about these things is why we can only talk in these broad generalities. But one of the things I think we should do is we should always have the most complex understanding of it. And if we do that, then I am confident that the American population will be able to make their own judgments about this, and their judgments will be very different than what we have right now. So that's the first thing. The more facts, the better, because I think the facts, in fact, are on the side of justice, are on the side of compassion, and are on the side of democracy. Now, the other issue of whether what we're doing is anti-Israeli or... I mean, again, the caller was... these terms got used interchangeably, anti-Israeli, sometimes it could be anti-Semitic, sometimes it's pro-Palestinian. I mean, this is actually the reason... This is the charge of being called anti-Semitic around these issues, that any time you raise these issues, you have a possibility of being labeled an anti-Semite. That, in fact, is one of the great silencing mechanisms. And that is what has kept lots of Jews quiet and lots of progressive Jews who, in fact, want to speak out, but have been kept quiet because of what they think the consequences will be of speaking out. And a lot of non-Jews have been quite quiet as well. Because you can't answer the charge of anti-Semitism. If someone calls me an anti-Semite, I can't say, no, I'm not.
It's like being called a child molester.
Yeah, what's the defense against it? And so a lot of the time, people just, they will not do what's needed. They will not say what they really think because they're afraid of what they'll be called. Not because it's true, but because there's no answer to it.
So
I can tell you in my own teaching, this worked to silence me for 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
I used to teach these classes, and for 10 years, I never dealt with this issue. I was dealing with issues of propaganda and control of media. And if you want to deal with, the classic propaganda case is the case of Israel in the Middle East. And so I had to ask myself, why wasn't I dealing with it? And I realized what it was it was about 5 years ago, 6 years ago, Edward Said, the great literary theorist and the Palestinian activist, came to speak here at UMass. Came to speak here in the Valley, out in Western Massachusetts. And he came here for a celebration of the work of Iqbal Ahmed, who, if your listeners don't know, is one of the great progressive activists and thinkers in the post-war generation. And he came here for a celebration of the work of Iqbal Ahmed. He's Pakistani, but his work, he was with Fanon in Algeria. He's done work in the Middle East, etc. And when Said got up to speak about Iqbal, Said had tears running down his eyes. And he said, the reason I'm here is that when the rest of the left and the rest of the progressive forces forgot the Palestinians, Iqbal didn't. He never forgot that the Palestinians and the cause of the Palestinians is one of the major causes to do with issues of justice and democracy in the world. And that the left, who dealt with Nicaragua and dealt with Guatemala and dealt with El Salvador and dealt with everything else, had forgotten Palestine. And when Said said this, I was forced to examine my own thinking around this. I said, he's right. Why haven't I dealt with this? Here I am, a tenured full professor at the University of Massachusetts. Why haven't I dealt with it? And I realized the reason I had not dealt with it is because I knew that when I dealt with issues to do with El Salvador or Nicaragua, no one in my class was going to get up and challenge me and call me a racist. But if the moment I started dealing with issues to do with the Middle East, that was a charge that was going to come. And that, in fact, had silenced me for 10 years. And I decided actually after listening to Saeed that I would not be silenced anymore, that in fact being silenced was an act of cowardice, and that if tenured full professors can't actually teach what they need to teach in an honest way, then I don't know why tenure exists.
Well, I think you just said very eloquently why tenure does exist and why it should exist.
And I wish more people would make use of it, to tell you the truth.
I share your opinion completely. We're talking to Sat Jolly today.
Can I just say one more thing?
You sure can, Sat.
Because I think the issue of anti-Semitism is very, you know, I think that's the silencing mechanism. That's why I think it's very important when, you know, because most Jews, when they ask them what's central to your Judaism, you know, when these surveys are done in the United States, most Jews say what's central to their Judaism is the concern that Judaism has with universal social justice, with universal social rights, not with particular social rights, not with particular social justice, but with universal social justice. And many Jews, in fact, are the most outspoken about what Israel is doing. And they think that for Israel to survive and for Israel, for Israel to be healthy, that they need to confront these issues. And so to take these positions is not to be anti-Israeli. In fact, I think for Israel to be secure means that we have to talk about these things in the most honest way. The only way in which you can have peace and security for everyone in the Middle East is to deal with these issues and to think about how we're going to have two viable states of Israel and Palestine in that area. And that perspective is not pro-Palestinian. That perspective, you know, is a perspective that is a peace perspective. And so progressive Jews, I think, have a special responsibility to speak about this, because progressive Jews can't be called anti-Semitic. They can be called self-hating Jews. But, you know, that's not as bad a charge as being anti-Semitic. And, in fact, you know, there's a lot of progressive Jews speaking out about this. And, again, one of the interesting things in the American media is how those progressive forces, how those progressive Jewish forces speaking out against the occupation, speaking out against the colonization by the settlements, how they are silenced on the American media. Let me give just two examples of people who are silenced. I mean, there's two groups that are nightmares for the Israeli public relations machine. One of them is rabbis, and there's a group called Rabbis for Human Rights. It's based in Israel. These are Israeli groups. Rabbis for Human Rights, that is an organization that battles for Palestinian rights. As well as for other rights as well. I mean, these are incredibly brave rabbis who, when the tanks are moving in to destroy homes, Palestinian homes, on the West Bank, they go and stand in front of the tanks and engage in civil disobedience. And they do that. They do that because they say for them to be good Jews and to be silent about what is happening to the Palestinians would be hypocrisy. For them to embody their Judaism means, in fact, that they have to take this stance. It's not actually pro-Palestinian. It's a stance for social justice. And again, that group is almost invisible. Is invisible on American media. The other group that's also pretty invisible, you know, are the officers, the reserve officers in the Israeli Defense Forces, who called refuseniks, who have refused to serve in the occupied territories. And these are not just, you know, conscripts. These are officers in the IDF. Who have said that that occupation of the West Bank and Gaza has nothing to do with the internal security of Israel, and that they will no longer participate in those activities. Those activities of occupation are essentially about humiliating a population, and that their Judaism and the principles on which Israel was founded has nothing to do with that. And so they've refused now to serve outside of Israel. Those two groups, because they give the lie to the notion that to say these things is to be anti-Semitic, those two groups have to be kept invisible from the American media. I think that's why I think it's the special responsibility of Jews. It's a special responsibility of all of us who care about social justice to speak out about these issues. But some people, you know, just as I can speak about sexism in a different way than women can, I think progressive Jews can speak about what's going on in the occupied territories in a different way than I can.
We're talking to Sat Jolly today in Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. We have time for another call or two at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. Sat has spoken today mostly about the Middle East and also about issues of gender, masculinity, sexism. and spoken, I think, brilliantly in both. What our listeners may not know, and I think we're going to have you on again for another show, Sat, is he's also one of the leading experts in advertising, consumer culture, media literacy, media education in the United States, if not the world. Let's go to the phone lines now and take another call for Sat Jolly. Urbana, you're on the air with Sat Jolly.
Hi. I just want to say that I've been listening to this rhetoric, and Seth, I think that you do hate Jews. And the reason why I say that is because I see no difference in your rhetoric and, let's say, the rhetoric of a lot of extremists in this country. For example, Church of the World Creator, where, specific references to...
Well, what's the Church of the World Creator, sir?
Church of World Creator.
What's that?
You're from Illinois and you never heard of that. It's in Peoria.
Oh, okay.
White supremacist group in Peoria.
Well, maybe some of our listeners don't know about it.
Well, okay. Let me give you, just on that topic, I mean, that group has been in Champaign speaking at the public library on at least three occasions over the past few years. And it shocks me that nobody is down there protesting, that this is allowed to go on and sanctioned by... tax dollars that are paid by Champaign County residents. I just don't understand.
Okay, so your point is...
If we're talking about a world issue, okay, if we're... What is your vested interest in pointing out what Jews should do and shouldn't do? What is your vested interest in this? That's my question, Seth. What is your interest?
Okay, thank you very much. Sat, what do you have to say?
My interest is in social justice and democracy. And I think all of us have a responsibility to speak out about those things. In some of these areas, some of us have more responsibility because of what our voices will do to the ongoing debate. This is not the only issue that's going on in the world. There are lots of issues going on in the world. And not all of us can participate in every single one. But one of the reasons why I think this debate, why the reason we have to have this debate in the United States is because the United States is centrally connected to this conflict. If it was not for the billions of dollars, by some estimates as much as $10 billion a year that goes to Israel, this conflict would not take place in its present form. And therefore, Americans have a special responsibility to become knowledgeable about these things. That's the answer to why. What's my stake? And my stake is a stake of humanity and of compassion and of democracy. The other issue is, let me deal with it, which you said, what I'm advocating or what I'm saying, the rhetoric I'm spouting, is anti-Semitic. Again, this is a very familiar accusation. Now, the other reason that anti-Semitism works as an accusation, one is that there's no answer to it. The other reason, of course, is that anti-Semitism is real and exists in the world. That anti-Semitism has had horrible effects. The Holocaust being the most spectacular, but we know that anti-Semitism has been a central aspect of racism in the West for hundreds of years. And so, and we know that in the present time, in Europe and in fact around the world, there is a rise in anti-Semitic activity. And therefore, to talk about this thing seems to be anti-Semitic. Well, it's only anti-Semitic if you make the connection that any criticism of Israel is automatically anti-Semitic. And that is what the Israeli public relations machine tries to do. Tries to say that any criticism of Israel is automatically anti-Semitic. And that simply is not true.
So,
therefore, I think it is also the responsibility for those of us who are non-Jews, as we criticize what the government of Israel is doing, at the same time, we also have to be in the front lines in the battle against anti-Semitism.
So we've got a ton of phone calls. Our lines are packed. We've got about 45 seconds left. I'm going to go to one caller if I can. Champagne, you're on the air with Sat Jolly.
Is this line two?
Yes, it is, line two.
Hi, Professor McChesney, thanks for your wonderful show. I just want to comment on this Israeli refuseniks, one of them belonging to an organization called Eshgol, which means there is a limit. A senior spokesperson of that, one Ram Rahat Goodman, was here last May, and he echoed your views exactly. He said a group of them are refusing to serve outside of the occupied territories simply to humiliate an entire people. And he was asking for support from all quarters internationally of all religions to put more pressure on the U.S. to reduce the support for the Israeli government. and also to write to the Israeli media and Israeli government and Israeli embassies here. So thanks for highlighting these views.
Sut, I'm going to go to another caller of our last one.
Sure.
Line 4 in Chicago, you're on the air with Sut Jolly.
Thank you very much for a good show. Naomi Klein was a guest on your show a few weeks ago, and she wrote a splendid essay that the left must continue to denounce anti-Semitism while still calling the information as they see it as what's going on in the Middle East. In Chicago, we have a group called Not In My Name that has maintained vigils every week for a year, saying that they do not, they want to end the occupation, and they are Chicago Jews. They have finally attracted a rousing opposition that shows up every week, but that doesn't negate the fact that the issues are being discussed. We also have the opportunity to hear people like Yuri Avneri, a former Knesset member who denounces the occupation and says that things need to go back to pre-67. My question, though, is what do we do with the ignorant American public who don't know about world issues? You can't make people care. How do we relate it to their own personal issues?
We only have a few seconds left, caller. I'm hate to do this. I'm going to turn this over to Sut for some final comments.
Sure.
The most important thing is education. And education can take place in many different ways, not just in classrooms, but in ways we speak to our neighbors and to our friends. And it's to remember all the time that, you know, we're involved in an educational process. And the other way is to connect it up directly to people's lives, which is that the Americans are not separate from the conflict that's going on. That in fact it is American tax dollars that is funding the conflict. And that if American tax dollars were to be diverted somewhere else, the nature of that conflict would change. And so Americans need to know about this because they have a special stake in what's going on.
Well, Sut, I just want to thank you very much for being our guest, and we'll have to have you on again because I've got a long list of things I want to talk about, and we barely got to talk about any of them on the show today. Can I just talk a little bit quickly, though, to close out with the media literacy movement, the movement that does what you're trying to do, educate people about how media works. And I think that answers a lot of the questions that last caller had about what do we do. What's the status of media literacy today in the U.S.?
On the one hand, I think it's very healthy because a lot of people want to, I'm starting to realize now that dealing with the media is absolutely vital. And that we need to, just as, you need to teach people how to read and write, you need to also teach people how to understand the incredible influx of images that they're in, that they're engulfed by. And that literacy is as important as standard kinds of literacy. At the same time, there's not a lot of institutional support for it right now.
Sut Jolly, I want to thank you very much for being our guest. I hear the band just started up in the background, so they're moving in for the next show.
My pleasure. It's
been a pleasure having you, Sut. We'll have to have you back on the air again soon.
Anytime.
And I'd like to thank Ben Byrne, who's our able producer this week, while Ben Scott's in Germany celebrating his wedding. And I'd like to thank you all for listening to Media Matters. We'll be back next week with Carrie McLaren and Gary Ruskin. I'm Bob McChesney. Have a good week.